It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, who doesn't love breakfast? And who says you can only have it in the morning? On this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll share some breakfast ideas that'll taste great no matter what time it is. First, when COVID-19 hit, there were big worries about the impact it could have on state and local budgets. Shutdowns, business closures, and a big jump in unemployment had many states worried that they'd suffer long-term revenue losses like they did during the Great Recession. A new analysis, though, has found that a lot of states' revenues remained at the same level that they were in 2019. In some states, they even increased. In part, that was because of federal aid packages. And state and local budgets are a part of the story in the relief package in the U.S. Senate today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How did the pandemic affect your business, your personal financial situation? If you work in local government, a city, town, county, village, you name it, did you take a hit early last year? Have you recovered? Are there challenges you are still facing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Louise Shaner is an economist and senior fellow at the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution. Louise, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, among the many scary things about COVID, obviously the health impacts first and foremost, there was this concern last year, March, April, as we had all these shutdowns, that this was going to really wreck a lot of state and local budgets. What were the concerns from the vantage point of, say, March, April 2020?
So, yeah, last March and last April, people were talking about the potential for $1 trillion in losses in state and local revenues. And the way they kind of calculated that was to look at the experience of the Great Recession, look at the huge increase in the unemployment rate in April, and sort of say, well, you know, for every 1 percentage point of the unemployment rate, state and local governments, you know, tend to lose this many billions of dollars. And they calculated these numbers that were just huge. And that turned out to be not the case. This recession is really different from previous recessions. First of all, apart from the fact that this recession is very different, one of the things that happened is the unemployment rate came down quite a bit faster than people realized. But even controlling for that, this recession is different in part, as you said, because of the big fiscal packages that have been passed. For example, the increase in unemployment benefits in the last spring's legislation, the CARES Act, which increased unemployment benefits by $600 per week. In most states, unemployment insurance is taxable. Not all states, but most, which means that even though unemployment was up, actually taxable income didn't fall that much. Similarly, this turned out, and this is also not a good thing, but this recession is particularly concentrated on low-income workers, people who are in the service industries, travel, hospitality, all that stuff has been really, really affected. The wages in those industries are quite low. So that meant for a given unemployment rate, the loss of taxable income was pretty small. And for higher income people, they've done quite well. You know, their unemployment really hasn't suffered. It did in April, but it's back. And then finally, the stock market's done incredibly well after swooning in March. So it fell in March. Everybody's like, oh, it was low stocks. But no, it's actually done very well. That's also boosting state and local revenues.
And that's mostly income taxes we've been talking about so far. A lot of states, including Wisconsin, rely and local governments rely in part on sales taxes. And again, if people are unemployed, they're presumably not able to buy stuff. That's going to hurt sales taxes. How much did the relief package allow levels of spending to stay at a more normal level?
So levels of spending aren't at a normal level. They're down, but it's not mostly because people didn't have the money. So unlike other recessions, lower income people, actually, their spending has been sort of stronger than higher income people. And that's mostly because of the kinds of things that they buy. So higher income people have not been consuming that much because all they can't go out to eat and the travel. There's so many things that are kind of restrained, not because of money, but because of social distancing. The packages help keep consumption from falling a lot, given the increase in unemployment, and so really did help bolster revenues. But tax revenues are down on sales taxes still, but again, not as much as you might expect, because sales taxes tend to tax goods more than services, And goods people are buying online and able to buy, it's really the services that have been hurt so much. So that's helped somewhat as well.
One key word you just said there, online. And I've seen some economists say, you know, if this had happened 5 years ago or so before we had really consistent tax collection from online purposes, this could have hurt state governments a lot more. How much of a difference does that collection of taxes, state taxes on online purchases really make?
You know, I think it's quite large. You've seen this big shift to online shopping, but I personally haven't done any estimates of what that would be. But I presume it'd be quite large. The one source of revenue that's really interesting, that's really taken a hit in COVID, are anything related to transportation, gas taxes, airport taxes. State and local governments actually received quite a lot of revenue from that, and that's been hurt a lot. So transit agencies, have definitely seen their revenues plummet.
Talking to Louise Shaner from the Brookings Institution, looking at the impact of COVID-19 on state budgets, local government budgets. Not as big a hit as expected at the outset. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did enhanced unemployment help you keep spending on things you needed to buy? If you work in a local government, if you're on a town or county board, what have things looked like for you? Smooth sailing or tough times? 800-642-1234. Louise, this is kind of on average. It looks like some states have taken a bigger hit. Looking at a map, I've seen North Dakota, Alaska, and Texas saw revenue drops. I'm assuming there's oil has something to do with that. Local governments, it might depend if you're in a tourist-heavy area or not. How much of this is a localized problem?
So we don't have great data on the local. We have very good data on what's happened so far at the state level, but the local, because there's so many different governments, we don't have great data. But one thing is that property taxes, which is a very large component of local tax collections, have held up quite well. The housing market's been very strong. So I think on average, local governments are probably doing okay, except I think one thing that happened was at the beginning of the pandemic, when we were all so worried about these huge losses, state governments actually cut aid to local governments. And so I think that is the way that sort of that early action has really put a lot of local governments in a squeeze. And we'll have to see what happens next year. But as you mentioned, there's also quite a bit of variation across the states. You mentioned energy states. So energy states are doing poorly, but oil prices are down if they get a lot of their revenues from severance taxes on that. Alaska's not doing well. And then tourist states are also doing badly. And then finally, states that don't have an income tax and are reliant on sales taxes and property taxes are taking a bigger hit.
Now, each time there's been an attempt at a federal relief package, the CARES Act or what have you, there's been a lot of talk about, okay, do we need big federal help for state and local governments? It was kind of put off in earlier packages. It's there some in the Biden package that the Senate is debating and kind of stalled on today. Do you think there needs to be a substantial federal investment to help state and local governments?
So even though there has been no direct aid so far in terms of just like general aid to offset general revenue losses, there has been a lot of aid. It's just been targeted at like K-12 education or hospitals or higher ed. And so there and a transit. So I think there have been about $400 billion already in aid to state and local governments. But the big missing piece in this discussion, and one reason I don't actually ever answer that question is, so revenues have been down, not as much as they expected, but they are down, now down relative to what would have happened without the pandemic. The aid has probably been larger than the revenue losses, but expenses are up, right? And that's the thing that's really hard to tell. We don't have a good handle on not just how much expenses have increased so far, but how much that should go up like in the year ahead. And one of the examples is if you think about what's happened with schooling, we know that a lot of kids have gotten behind, right? And so the right thing to do would be for the state and local governments to really invest in remedial education. We don't know how much this is going to cost. We don't know how much the vaccine rollout is going to cost or cleaning up the schools to get them open is going to cost. So we don't have a great sense. So I think that given how important it is to do things like the remedial education and sort of benefit to taxpayers who need it because of COVID in other ways, small business who might need help getting back online, I support giving state and local governments more money. So I think that they will use it by and large appropriately. And so, but I don't really have a good number on exactly how much they need because I just don't know how much those COVID expenses have been.
We're talking to Lee Shaner, senior fellow at the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution. We're looking at the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on state and local governments. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Should the newest round of likely, anyway, COVID-19 relief include this sort of direct aid for state and local governments? Did past aid packages help you keep your business open, keep your household intact, maybe while you were unemployed? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Brookings Institution economist Louise Shaner. She's telling us about her research on how the pandemic affected state tax revenues. And we're taking a look at the proposed $1.9 trillion economic relief plan before the U.S. Senate today. Still time for you to join in if you'd like with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Louise, I know a lot of states early on cut expenses. You mentioned cutting aid to local governments in some ways. Some states laid off workers. Some, like Wisconsin, had furloughs for some state many state employees. Do you see those measures still in place, or are states starting to bounce back and bring those people back on the job?
So I'm going to apologize. My dog is downstairs and barking.
That's okay. We get to meet a lot of people's pets during the pandemic. It's been fine.
So I think that the employment situation, a question, is really an interesting one. The layoffs were very large. Employment is about 6% below where it has been. It's particularly in education and state and local education, employment is both down. And so one question is whether or not those declines in employment were because states were worried about money, or whether they're because you don't actually need all the employees, given the fact that your schools are still closed. Some of your parks are closed. Your DMVs are operating at a third capacity. And I think it's some combination thereof. And really, they haven't requested. I mean, things fell very sort of deeply in last spring. They recovered somewhat over the summer, but they're still quite down, about 6 or 7% relative to pre-pandemic. So part of that might be states just being really cautious. I know some of them put hiring freezes in because of money and perhaps have not stopped them yet. But I think part of it will sort of start to come back as the economy starts to reopen, as vaccinations increase. But we'll have to see. That's sort of a mystery about why employment has fallen so much, given the fact that the revenue situation is really not that bad.
One criticism of the idea of federal relief, direct aid to state and local governments, some Republicans have described it as a blue state bailout, in some ways benefiting states, I guess, with Democratic governors or that traditionally vote Democratic more than others. Is there any indication that it would shake out that way in the kinds of aid that have been proposed?
I don't think so. I mean, most of the aid, so there was a $150 billion package passed last spring, and it was divided up across states by population, except that there was sort of a minimum level of $1.25 billion that went to the small states. And so the small states actually did very well from that package. And those were not particularly Democratic states. Some of them were, but most of them are small Republican states. So I don't think so. I think this is really intended to help deal with the effects of COVID. And I don't think that's a red state, blue state issue.
Now, you've also written about the possible overall economic impact on the economy of the proposed new relief package, again, subject to change today, even in the Senate. Big picture, though, what kinds of impacts do you look at that having on the American economy if passed?
Right. So it's a really big package, and there has been quite a bit of aid as well. And so we did this estimate trying to sort of figure out, you know, what you do is you say, well, who's getting the money and how likely they are to spend it, and how quickly will they spend it? And then what will the impact on, you know, when someone spends a dollar, then somebody else receives a dollar. And so it has extra effects on GDP. So we did this analysis. And what we found out was without the aid, if we take the Congressional Budget Office economic projection, right, so it depends on what you think will happen without it. They say without it, we're going to be below where we were and where we would have been in terms of GDP, sort of economic activity for many years. And we said with the package, we're actually going to get sort of even above where we otherwise would have been. So we'll have by sort of the third quarter of this year, if the package passes, probably quite a booming economy, right? And so we'll have sort of, people will have enough money to make up for some of the losses that they didn't, sort of the things they didn't buy and the restaurants they didn't go to and the vacations they didn't take. Sort of, they'll be able to sort of do a whole bunch of that and really get the economy sort of moving and really kind of recovering very, very quickly. And I think that's the benefit of that is one of the things that people worry about is if you kind of have a mediocre recovery, then some of the people have left the labor force because they couldn't get a job. There's a lot of women who have left the labor force. And if you don't have a lot of impetus in the economy, maybe they'll just stay out, right? So maybe we'll have a very sort of poor economy for many years because of the sort of legacy effects of COVID. But if you do this thing that really runs the economy hot, I think you're less likely to. What people argue about is whether or not it's too much money, mm-hmm. whether or not you're going to have so much demand and still not have enough supply, right? Everybody's going to want to go and buy stuff and they won't be able to supply it all. And whether or not that will create inflation. And so then you get start talking about the Federal Reserve and monetary policy, and they've actually said they would welcome some inflation because we haven't had as much as inflation as they've wanted over the past 10 years. So they're going to welcome a period where inflation is kind of higher. But then the argument is about, well, how high is too high? And, you know, at some point will we say that was just the economy's just, you know, going crazy and there's just way too much inflation, and then they'll have to raise interest rates. So that's what the debate's all about. But in our estimate, like, it's probably going to bring inflation up a little, but we are not too concerned about it. And we think it will sort of get the recovery going sort of very quickly, bring the unemployment rate down. And that really is very helpful for people. You know, a low unemployment rate is particularly helpful for people who don't have great education, who are sort of more marginally attached to the labor force. Maybe they have prison records. All those things that were before the pandemic, the unemployment rate was really, really low. It was 3.5%, and it was really great. And a big package can get us there fast, which would be really valuable.
And we'll leave it there. Louise, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Louise Shaner, Senior Fellow at the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution, with us for a look at the impact the COVID-19 pandemic had on state and local budgets. Even in the hyperpartisan atmosphere of Washington, D.C., Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson keeps turning heads lately. Johnson has said a lot, from questioning the results of the election to downplaying the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The comments strike many political observers as a clear sign that Johnson will seek a third term in the Senate at a time when the Republican Party's base still supports Donald Trump. Sean Johnson reports.
A recent Senate hearing on the insurrection started out harmoniously. Senators from both parties had just weathered the siege together a few weeks earlier. They pledged to work together to find out what happened. There were pointed questions from Democrats like Minnesota's Amy Klobuchar.
Would you agree that this attack involved white supremacists and extremist groups?
Yes.
Okay.
And Republicans like Ohio's Rob Portman.
Why wouldn't we be prepared for an infiltration of the Capitol?
And testimony from law enforcement leaders who were at the Capitol on January 6th, like former U.S. Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund.
I witnessed insurgents beating police officers with fists, pipes, sticks, bats, metal barricades, and flagpoles. These criminals came prepared for war.
But the tone changed when it was Ron Johnson's turn. Instead of asking questions, he spent most of his time reading someone else's account of what happened that day from the conservative website, The Federalist. It described the mood of the crowd that attended Trump's Stop the Steal rally on January 6th as positive and festive.
Many of the marchers were families with small children. Many were elderly, overweight, or just plain tired or frail. Traits not typically attributed to the riot prone.
The article referenced four groups of people who stood out: militants, provocateurs, fake Trump protesters, and disciplined attackers. As Johnson read from the piece, he paused to offer his take.
I think these are the people that probably planned this.
The comments rubbed many in the room the wrong way. After all, on January 6th, they were whisked away with Johnson to secure locations when rioters overtook the Capitol, including the Senate chamber. It wasn't the first time Johnson had hinted at these ideas. Weeks earlier, Johnson went on conservative talk radio to question whether the insurrection was actually armed. Larry Sabato directs the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. He says people are surprised that Johnson is minimizing what happened.
It was an historic event, and it's going to be remembered a lot longer than Senator Johnson is.
A.B. Stoddard is an associate editor and columnist at Real Clear Politics. She says she knows Johnson, and she thinks he knows what he's saying isn't real. Her theory is that he's saying it anyway to try to win over Trump's GOP base.
You know, he's basically going where the wind is blowing. You know, his voters are asking for this, and he wants that job.
Johnson's office didn't respond to a request for an interview. He hasn't said yet whether he'll seek a third term. In 2016, Johnson promised he would not run again.
This will be my last term. I'll never vote my reelection mind because I'll never stand for reelection again.
Johnson has since walked back that pledge. Stoddard and Sabato say Johnson has changed since he was first elected. Back then, he ran as a political outsider and businessman who was fixated on reducing the debt. But Christian Schneider, a conservative writer and columnist who had behind-the-scenes access to Johnson's first campaign, sees a common thread. In 2010, Johnson's staff went to great lengths to get him to be more cautious at a time when he would frequently go off message. It never quite worked, but Johnson won anyway.
If there's any lesson that he's probably learned, it's to trust his gut. And his gut right now is telling him to kind of be the most pro-Trump senator imaginable.
This week, Johnson has moved on to a new issue, attacking President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 bill. But he didn't just debate the bill. Johnson forced Senate clerks to read the entire thing aloud, hour after hour, to a nearly empty Senate chamber.
402A2 of Division N of the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021, Public Law 116-260.
Democrats said the move would only delay $1,400 checks and extended jobless benefits to Americans who need them. While the parliamentary tactic is exceedingly rare in the Senate, it seemed like familiar territory for Johnson, who these days jumps quickly from one controversy to the next. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
After the news, hope you like breakfast, because we're going to give you a whole lot of it in this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll get some new ideas to start our days off right coming up. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes joins the program for a look at climate change initiatives in the governor's budget proposal. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, you were probably told at some point that breakfast is the most important meal of the day, and if you skip it, you'll be sorry. Well, it turns out the science is kind of murky on that, so we'll leave it alone. But a 2019 survey from one poll says Americans only eat breakfast 3 times a week on average. When we do eat, what do we like? Eggs. 65% said they prefer eggs for breakfast. 58% said just the coffee. 56% go with the bowl of cereal. I know what you're thinking. What about the bacon? Only 42%, but maybe they really like their bacon, like Ron Swanson from Parks and Recreation.
Just give me all the bacon and eggs you have. Wait. I worry what you just heard was give me a lot of bacon and eggs. What I said was give me all the bacon and eggs you have. Do you understand?
And who says you can only have breakfast in the morning? A different poll said almost 7 in 10 people enjoy breakfast for dinner. On this edition of Food Friday, we're digging into breakfast foods any time of day, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a breakfast fan? What do you typically have? What's your favorite breakfast item? How do you like your eggs? If you prefer oatmeal, what do you put in it? You like sweet stuff that could be a dessert, like cinnamon rolls, scones, and muffins. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. James Shend is the deputy editor for Taste of Home, which, by the way, is based in Milwaukee. James, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, are you a big breakfast guy, whether it's in the morning or breakfast foods for the other times of day?
Oh, I am a huge breakfast guy. I cannot understand people that do not have breakfast. I just don't.
And what is your go-to breakfast meal?
Well, if I'm being honest, it's oatmeal. I usually do this baked oatmeal that we have on the Taste of Home website. But my real love is pancakes. I will do pancakes every weekend.
Yeah, so there's the difference between, you know, the quick before work breakfast and the fancy, maybe it bleeds into brunch on the weekend type meals.
Right,
What do you do to make a great pancake? I make pretty good pancakes, but I don't know. I could up my pancake game.
Well, there's a lot of things you can do. I tend to like a light, fluffy pancake. Mm-hmm. And so I'll use a little bit of baking soda and a little baking powder. And then sometimes I'll even separate out the egg whites and then beat those separately and fold them in. So you end up with this really puffy, almost cake-like pancake.
You know, I do that for waffles. I'll separate the egg whites and blend them, you know, fluff them up. I don't think I've ever done that for pancakes. It really does make a difference.
Oh, it's great for that. And I tend to use water in my pancakes instead of milk for a couple of reasons. But if you substitute sparkling water, you get even more lift.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned that oatmeal, and you've shared a few recipes from Taste of Home. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. One of them is this overnight cherry almond oatmeal. So what goes into making this like a slow-cooked oatmeal?
Right. So this one is a little different. Lately, we've seen a lot of these overnight oatmeals, which you just combine oatmeal or, oats with almond milk or regular milk and stick it in the refrigerator. What I like about this one is you wake up and you have a hot breakfast that is really tasty ready for you. So all you're going to be doing is this one uses almond milk, steel cut oats, which is the Irish oats or the Scottish oats. So they're the real firmer ones that have a nice texture. And then you can use some dried cherries or cranberries if you'd like. A little bit of brown sugar. You don't need a lot because a little will go a long way. And then you just toss everything in the slow cooker, put it on low, and then right before you go to bed, and then it's all ready for you when you wake up.
Now, we talk about a lot of things on this network, and the surest way to generate calls, James, is to ask people what they put in their oatmeal for some reason. What are some of your other favorites? This one has the cherries and almonds. What else do you like to throw in?
I love wild blueberries. I can get them from our local store frozen. And so I love to put those in any kind of fresh fruit is usually my go-to. I tend to stay away from sugar and honey just because I don't like a sweeter honey or a sweeter oatmeal. So I tend to skip all of that, maybe just a little sprinkling on top if I'm serving it to somebody else. But then spices like cinnamon, ginger, cloves, nutmeg, pumpkin pie spice is also great in here as well.
We've got that overnight cherry almond oatmeal recipe up at WPR.org/Food Friday. It is Food Friday. James Shend is with us from Taste of Home. We're making breakfast for any time of day or maybe anything for breakfast. You can join in with your favorites at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Dave is with us in Augusta. Dave, hello.
Hello, hello. I like to have about 5 in the morning a nice bowl of oatmeal topped with granola. Go ahead.
Is the granola cooked, Dave, or do you like you make the oatmeal and just like sprinkle the raw, I guess not really raw, but the granola right on top of it?
Right on top of it, yep. And then off to the side, I have a real slim piece of chocolate raspberry pie.
Wow.
And it's only about an inch left to right. It's a very small piece, but I should put that on top of everything and mix it all together.
I love it.
It is absolutely delicious.
So Dave, you said that's 5 in the morning. Don't you feel full when you go back to bed?
Of course I do.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Dave. I love it. Well, I like the granola. So I mean, the oatmeal, obviously people like some crunch in it sometimes, that the almonds and that one recipe can do that. James, the granola does it here.
Yeah, I like the idea of the granola. Gets you that extra texture plus an extra layer of flavor.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dave. He's got that pie on the side, and that reminds me a lot of, you know, there's a lot of foods that are at that borderline between breakfast and dessert. I make a lot of apple crisp, which it can kind of go either way. One of the recipes you shared with us is a red velvet cinnamon roll. So red velvet, but for cinnamon rolls. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this one is fun. This recipe came from Erin Wright in Kansas, and she starts by using a cake mix. So it's a red velvet cake mix. And then she adds her yeast and some more flour to it and just treats it like a normal cinnamon roll dough. And so you get this really bright, inviting red color. And then it's filled with that brown sugar cinnamon swirl inside. And it's got the beautiful powdered sugar frosting on it. What I really love about this one is you can customize it however you like. If you're not a big red velvet fan, substitute a chocolate cake mix or an orange or a spice cake mix. And so whatever cake mix you have or would like to try, it's not going to go wrong. I guarantee you it won't.
Again, we've got that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Sharon is with us in Appleton. Sharon, hi.
Hi. Well, we probably do things a little differently. Our daughter is an acupuncturist, and part of Chinese medicine says you should have dinner for breakfast. And we've been doing this for many, many years now. And so, like, we will have, you know, stir fry, or we'll have leftover shrimp pasta, or we'll have even leftover chicken and rice or vegetables. And what we have found is it really reduces the number of carbs that you're eating, and it totally increases the number of vegetables you're getting every day because, you know, you just have more vegetables usually with your meal at dinner time, and we don't get a lot of vegetables with a typical breakfast diet. So we found that it's just been a great way to do it, and we happen to love leftovers, and so we always have leftovers, and whatever we eat at night, we usually eat in the morning.
And Sharon, my understanding is this may sound weird to us here in America. We're the weirdos, like in how much we separate breakfast foods from other foods, at least compared to the rest of the world. Was it a big adjustment for you? Did it take some getting over to be ready to eat stir fry in the morning?
Well, for us, it was easy because we're gluten free.
Okay.
And for a while, I couldn't eat eggs. So if you're gluten free and you can't eat eggs and you're limited on dairy, it becomes like, oh, my God, what can I eat? And dinner for breakfast was the perfect alternative. And we were in Southeast Asia a couple years ago, and every place we went, we had wonderful soups for breakfast and stir fries for breakfast. That was just what was available.
Thanks so much for sharing that, Sharon. I appreciate it. James, do you have any dinner-type foods that you like, or what we consider dinner-type foods that you eat for breakfast? I know I've been through phases in my life of the leftover pizza first thing in the morning.
Oh, yeah. That I've had that phase as well. I'm a big fan of eating that way, too, trying to get as many vegetables and fruits into your diet. And like the breakfast meal tends to be, for Americans anyways, lacking in a lot of that, just what Sharon said. And so there have been a couple of ways that I have tried to incorporate things in there. And one of them, I get back to the oatmeal thing, is a lot of people only look at oatmeal as a breakfast item. Like, this is the only way to serve this. And they always usually tend to go sweet with it. But oatmeal is a great way to go savory. And so you can, like, instead of the cinnamon and the ginger, throw in some rosemary. You can even throw in a little bit of garlic as well and put a fried egg on top, and you get it a very savory play to it. Go ahead and throw in a whole bunch of sauteed vegetables. I usually will do it in olive oil just because it is a little bit healthier than butter. I'm sorry, my Wisconsin dairy people. That is one of those things that can easily go sweet or savory. And again, you can bring it to breakfast for dinner. And that's when it seems a little bit more approachable and people are a little bit more ready to experiment with that savory flavor of oatmeal.
It's Food Friday with a focus on breakfast foods with James Shend, Deputy Editor for Taste of Home. We've got three recipes posted at WPR.org/Food Friday from Taste of Home. Quiche pastry cups, overnight cherry almond oatmeal, and red velvet cinnamon rolls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite breakfast dish, or maybe something we think of as a breakfast thing that you'll eat anytime, or vice versa? Not breakfast foods that you like in the morning. 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're picking up our talk on breakfast food with James Shend, deputy editor for Taste of Home based in Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite breakfast food? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go back to your calls now. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi. I am calling because I think I may be James's breakfast twin. I, too, have oatmeal every day for breakfast. I'd much rather have pancakes, but I never make pancakes because I have a 14-year-old, and I frankly don't want him eating pancakes every day. And pancakes just kind of make me feel like I've just eaten dessert, like there's not a lot of nutritional value there. So what I've been doing is making my pancakes with oat flour instead, and they taste amazing, and I feel like I'm getting more nutrition there, and even the 14-year-old loves them.
Excellent. I love it, Laura. Yeah, we don't have to have just straight-up white flour pancakes, do we, James?
No, we don't. And I was going to ask Laura, how do you get the oat flour? Do you just process oatmeal in a food processor?
Are you still there, Laura?
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
Yeah. How do you buy straight-up oat flour, or do you grind down some oatmeal?
So I just started out using the oatmeal that I already had on hand, which couldn't be easier, but I only have a small coffee grinder, so it takes forever. So, I mean, you can do that in a pinch, but now I buy the oat flour, which I think is just simply that, just the ground oatmeal.
Laura, thanks a lot for that call. You know, I used to do this all the time. My kids don't like it, though. Cornmeal mixed into my pancakes. That really put it over the top for me, James. Other grains you like to experiment with?
Like you said, the cornmeal is great, especially if you fry the pancakes in bacon fat. But almost any grain can go into a pancake batter. So if you're going to use just a regular all-purpose flour batter, you can throw in a lot of cooked grains to begin with. But as Laura was saying, that you can grind up other flour or other oats and grains and things to a powdery form. You just have to remember you may have to add a little bit more egg to keep the whole thing together because you're not going to build that gluten that the normal wheat flour would do. So I just keep experimenting. I'm going to try Laura's trick, and I'm going to try to make some grind up some flour tomorrow and make some oatmeal pancake.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Will next, calling from Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Gentlemen, great show. Here's a favorite of mine. First of all, in the morning, I'm a night guy, and I'm almost comatose until I have my first couple cups of coffee, especially that first one. But after a couple hours, I enjoy boiling up some oatmeal with low-fat milk or skim milk, regular oatmeal, and throw in some cinnamon while that's cooking. And then after it's been in there a bit, toss in some raisins, you know, so they kind of plump up. Mm. And when it's done, put it in a bowl and top it off with some walnuts, maybe a little bit of granola, some blueberries, and then as sweetener, you could either put in, sometimes I'll put in some brown sugar while it's cooking, or when it's done, I'll top it off with some maple syrup. And it's just the way to start the day. So
fantastic. Well, that sounds great. Thanks so much. Yeah, James, like I said, people have their oatmeal favorites. And that one, that's just chock full of stuff. There's hardly any room for oatmeal there, it sounds like.
Right. I'm getting a couple of story ideas here. I think we need to do something on oatmeal now.
Yes. That's what people are looking for, man. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Hey, I want to check out one more recipe you shared with us before we go back to our callers, James. This one, quiche pastry cups. There's some eggs. I think there's some bacon in this one. Tell us about these guys.
This one is a little over the top, and it looks fancy, and it can really be for a nice, like a Mother's Day brunch, but it's also a great idea for breakfast on the go. And so what you do is you start out with a frozen puff pastry that you thaw out. You just cut them into pieces, stuff them into your regular muffin cups, and then inside of those, you're going to have a mixture of half and half, eggs, some herbs like thyme, pepper, a little nutmeg, and then Gruyere or Swiss cheese, and then some fresh spinach. along with a red pepper, and then 8 slices of bacon that are cooked and crumbled. And you just pour all that in. So it's a quiche that's wrapped up in a piece of puff pastry. And then after you bake it, if you want to have these for later on, you can cool them down and then freeze them and then pop them in a freezer safe bag or a container, and then take them out in the, when you're heading out to work. When you get to the office, just pop them in a toaster oven to reheat for about 15 minutes, and they reheat beautifully. They'll stay in the freezer for about 6 months.
That sounds fantastic. We've got that recipe with some other breakfast recipes up at WPR.org/Food Friday. James Shend is with us from Taste of Home. Talk about great breakfast foods. Back to your calls now. Terry is with us in Glen Flora. Terry, hi.
Hi. Wonderful show. I like the oatmeal recipes too, but mine is about a frittata.
Ooh. What goes into your frittata, Terry?
We use zucchini instead of potatoes. We just grow it in the garden, shred it. We have to drain it, all the liquid off in the winter, but we use it fresh in the summer. And, you know, we fry that up with onions and olive oil and mushrooms and peppers and whatever we have. A lot of green spinach is really nice in it, too. And then I beat the eggs and I put them in and let it solidify a little bit. And I have the oven preheating, and I finish it in the oven with cheese and tomatoes sliced on top. And it is really good. But there's only 2 of us, and we just make it in a 9 or 10-inch frying pan, and then we have more next day to heat in the microwave. So it's a good way to start the day.
Fantastic, Terry, and a good way to use up Wisconsin's glut of zucchini in the season. James, do you have a favorite filling for frittatas or quiches, for that matter?
Usually I go with ham. Ham is a really good meat or protein to go in quiches. It's very classic, like the quiche Lorraine is based on ham. But any kind of meat, and what I love about frittatas and quiches is it's whatever you have can go in it, and it works beautifully. So if you've had a roast beef from last night, just chop it up, finally throw it in there. It's going to be great. Pot roast turkey, I've even roast chicken, tofu is even really good. I mean, it sounds odd, but you can cube up some tofu, throw it in, and it almost simulates a little cheese. So for the people that can't eat cheese, it's a good substitute for it. But it's a great way to pack in a lot of veggies as well. And so I always have onions on hand, so onions always have to go in. And there's usually some peppers or whatever's growing in the garden in the summertime. And again, if it's leftover veggies from last night, I've even thrown in Brussels sprouts and green beans into a quiche, and it always turns out really well.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Madeline is with us in Saner. Madeline, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I do love breakfast. It's my favorite meal of the day. One that I really enjoy making is during Passover. Many of us Jews can't eat any bread for a couple of weeks, and Passover is coming up. And I always had matzah brei, which you take like this cracker that's tasteless, and you just soak it in some water. You put it in some eggs, fry it up. My father often put maple syrup into. He'd do that with his sausage, too, to kind of caramelize it with some maple syrup. And you just put salt on it, and it's always delicious. And whenever I eat it, I think of my grandma making it for me, even during non-Passover times. And for something like that, I do that with corn tortillas other times, just kind of soaking it up and then pulling in the eggs and frying it from there, which I love.
Fantastic. Thanks, Madeline. And we'll give you the last word. James, that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.
That's James Shend, Deputy Editor for Taste of Home. He joined us for Food Friday for some great breakfast ideas. Find recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up Monday on Central Time, job numbers bounced up last week, but our guest says there are many jobs, maybe millions lost in the pandemic that may not come back. We'll find out what could replace them. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. The mullet may be making a comeback. That's the hairstyle, not the fish. The haircut, you may remember, is short on top, long in the back. It was really big, like in the 80s, 90s era. There was a backlash, and it became kind of a running joke in pop culture. Now, apparently, some big names are bringing it back, and according to some reporting, people are seeking out the haircut, ironically or otherwise. I'm not going to get into the mullet pro-con debate right now, but I learned a few things today. One, the mullet haircut has a long history going back to ancient times. According to the History Channel, you can find a mullet reference in Homer's Iliad, where some soldiers are described as having their forelocks cropped, hair grown long at the backs. I also saw my first reference today to Benjamin Franklin sporting a skullet, bald on top, long in the back. You can picture those pictures of Ben Franklin. A chilling vision of things to come for me with long hair and a family history of going bald at the top. But wait, there's more. There's a European competition for the biggest mullet currently held by a man in Belgium. Well, it's got me wondering, should I join the mullet comeback? I'll mullet over. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.